Hi, this is Jay Washburn.
And I'm Joe Bendosky.
And this is Start Writing.
And this is our first attempt at just a remote recording. So we'll see how it goes. And it might make it easier for when Jay's out of town.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a continuation of our discussion on exposition and dialogue. And so as we covered very briefly in our first episode, there's a lot of writing advice that tells you cut all the backstory, cut all the exposition. It's boring. It slows it down. Get rid of it. And that's not the advice we want to look at. What we want to look at is how you can structure that backstory and that exposition in a way that strengthens the story, that continues to make it engage. And so the example I really want to look at is if we look at like the way the Bible does backstory and exposition, we get, and the Midichlorians beget Anakin, and Anakin beget Luke. And it's just, page after page of this, and it's really dull and boring. But we get that same piece of information in the Star Wars story where Darth Vader is in this physical conflict with Luke, and he says, "Luke, I am your father." Right? That's the same piece of information as that list of begats that I gave. But now it no longer feels like dull exposition. It feels essential to the story, and is known as one of the greatest surprises in all of cinema, right? And it's backstory. That's all that it is. It's just a piece of backstory. Darth Vader is Luke's father.
Man, I love that. That's such a different way to think about that, but it's exactly right. That's crazy.
And so that's what we're trying to look at today. How can we take these pieces of exposition and these pieces of backstory and make them strengthen the story rather than slow it down? So as we discussed in our previous episode, we are going to be looking at text from a couple different works to look at the examples to see how it was handled and discussed. So some of the examples we'll come from great thinkers on writing, about writing. We'll talk about Robert McKee and Lisa Crone and some of our favorites. But we'll also be reading from the novel The Expanse. We've tried to limit ourselves to the first four chapters, and we covered some of those examples last time. We'll also be reading from John Updike's A&P. And so these are some of the examples we'll be checking out. If you want to check out those novels, you can go to our website page. And then if you buy from Amazon from our website page, then that helps support the show. So, yeah. So we'll kind of just jump back to where we were. So we're looking at a piece of exposition from The Expanse. So, Jay, could you read this for me?
Yeah. "What have you found?" she asked, but her gaze was on the wall behind him. This wasn't a pop quiz. She was just making conversation. He replies, "Golden bows looking the same as Sahiro's crew and the Loka Griega. Still on station, but distracted, I guess I'd call it. They're letting little things slide. Fewer thugs on the ground, less enforcement. I've got half a dozen mid-level guys who've gone dark." He'd caught her attention. "Killed?" she asked. "An OPA advance?" An advance by the Outer Planets Alliance was the constant bogeyman of Ceres security. Living in the tradition of Al Capone and Hamas, the IRA, and the Red Marshals, the OPA was beloved by the people it helped and feared by the ones who got in its way. Part social movement, part wannabe nation, and part terrorist network, it totally lacked an institutional conscience. Captain Shadid might not like Havelock because he was from down a gravity well, but she'd work with him. The OPA would have put him in an airlock. People like Miller would only rate getting a bullet in the skull and a nice plastic one at that. Nothing that might get shrapnel in the ductwork."
So the piece of exposition we're looking at here is, they say, an OPA advance. So the dialogue itself tells us nothing about what OPA means. And so the author takes this brief sideline to explain what OPA means. It's the Outer Planet Alliance. That's what OPA means. And then we get a little bit of a backstory on it. But the interesting thing here, and this is kind of the same thing we see in A&P, if you remember from part one, is at the very end of this piece of exposition, the author ties it back into the characters we're following, into the characters we're invested. Havelock, we have met, he's a security officer on the asteroid, and he's from Earth, and so they don't like him just because he's from Earth, which they call a gravity well. Hmm. And then Miller is the character, he's the point of view character we're following at the moment, and he talks about the opinion that OPA has about these two people because of what they are and who they are. And so it's an as needed exposition. So it's a little rougher, but like I said, they bring it back to the characters and talk about how it matters to them individually. We also see this a lot, this as needed exposition in Michael Connelly's work. Michael Connelly uses a lot of police jargon, and a lot of times it's really hard to follow if you just look at the dialogue without his explaining what these little tags mean, because, you know, if you're not a police officer and you're deep in that work, you don't use that. But that's how the police actually talk to each other, because they're all familiar with these acronyms and abbreviations.
Yeah. So this seems really powerful to me, because essentially the characters can stay in character and the narrator can give us what we need to know. So that's like a really strong advantage. What's the downside to using this?
The downside is, we have several sentences that are dense. They're very heavy in what's, in the backstory here, explaining what the OPA is, right? So we have half the paragraph is just exposition. Not only that, but it comes in the middle of the dialogue between these two people. And so as we talked about the memory slots, it's possible that this much dense information right here could cause the reader to lose track of the action that's actually going on and the dialogue. So sometimes what you'll see happen is, if you need to do this kind of as needed exposition in a moment like this, just to make sure your reader doesn't get lost, then you'll sometimes have like the character give like a summary, one or two, to bring us back into the action where we were, just because of those memory slots. You want the read to be as smooth and relaxed as possible, and you don't want a reader to go back and be like, what were they talking about? Like, that should be covered in the next line of dialogue. You know, maybe they start with, be like, there's no way this is an OPA. Be like, them being killed has nothing to do with the OPA. And that sentence is just restating the conversation, right? It's adding an opinion to it, so there's new information, but it's restating that conversation so that the reader doesn't have to go back after you have that kind of info, that tight piece of exposition there. Because you're going to, that much information, we're going to plug all those memory slots right there. You know, even though we've tied it back to our characters to make sure it has emotional resonance to the characters we're following, we have filled all the memory slots and we have forgotten what the action is. And this leads right into the next point I can bring up. As opposed to having this dense exposition here, there's something we could do what are called tool tips. And these are really cool, and they're kind of new and developing, and they will never be part of paperback books. So essentially what a tool tip is it kind of developed out of like software and gaming, where you could like hold your mouse over to get information about something you might not no, like a little symbol or something. So in the gaming world, as they tried to make the games more immersive, to make you feel like you're really in this world and less what they call gamey, whereas gamey is you can see pieces on your screen that don't look like you're in another world. They're, you know, a hit point bar or, you know, text over somebody's head. All that stuff makes it really gamey. So tooltips was something they introduced into games to essentially give players the option to engage in backstory and exposition. And so the way it would work is, originally there was like a codex. You would get a piece of information you didn't understand, and then you'd have to look it up in like a glossary, right? And a lot of fantasy and sci-fi novels will have glossaries for this kind of thing. But what the tooltip did is it took that codex and moved it into the conversation. So let's say you have a piece of dialogue from a character you're talking to, and maybe they mention the OPA. Well, instead of getting an explanation of what the OPA is right there, you'd hold your mouse over and it would pop up a little mini screen saying, this is what OPA means. Well, an interesting thing developed with e-readers, and that they had that option. So initially what e-readers would do is you'd have vocabulary. So if you could you could click on a word you didn't recognize, and then it would pop up the meaning of that word. And based on the studies they did, they say people looking up words in books they read that they don't recognize jumped by 80%, because suddenly you didn't have to go grab your dictionary and look up the word, all of that. You just had to hold on that one word in the book, and suddenly it would tell you exactly what it meant. Then this got expanded to historical places and characters. Now you could highlight a character's name. So let's say you have the Comte de Lafayette. You could highlight his name, and it would tell you that this was a French marquis who had fought in the American Revolution and in the French Revolution. And so you could get that information immediately. You could also get it about locations like Stonehenge or Versailles. You know, you could get all that information, all that. And I haven't seen this in the Kindle. The Kindle will do historical places, people, and vocabulary. But in e-readers, I've seen it where the author can create their own glossary at the end and then connect that to the words and stuff in their book. And so instead of writing out the outer plan, instead of this, the whole top half of this paragraph where they're explaining what the OPA is, you could just skip it. And then if the reader wanted to know what OPA means, they click on it. And so it's this really interesting dynamic where the reader and or the player chooses, they opt in for exposition and backstory. They say, yes, I want more, give it to me. And so it creates a different dynamic in the flow of your story.
And so as you explained this, my first reaction was, I wouldn't want to use this. And then as I thought more about it, I thought, I would want to make my main story stand on its own just fine. But then, like you're saying, kind of the extra nerdy stuff.
The extra nerdy stuff,
Tool tip for like people that want to dive deep. It's like, okay, if you want this fun, action-packed, quick story, just read it. If you want to go deep because you're a nerd, now I have all these tool tips for you. That's awesome. Yeah.
So, in fact, one of the comments I got from my novels is at the end of my books, I put the historical notes. So anywhere I have deviated from the history, I have notes for that on that chapter. And multiple readers have requested that I have that option in chapter in the moment so they can see this is fiction, this is fact, and they can sort it out as they read it, so, as opposed to looking up at the end. Now, because Kindle doesn't have this option yet, it's for most of my readers, that's not available. But like I said, it's been requested.
Yeah, cool.
But yeah, I think it's really cool. And I think I think it's great if you're writing your first or your second novel and you're getting that feedback from your group or your beta readers, too much exposition, skip all this, throw this all out, just put it into the tool tips and then see how the novel flows, right? Because then, like you said, it's the extra nerdy stuff. People can dive into it if they want. And you, the writer, are not so hung up, be like, they need to know this. You can put it there for them to know. And if they really need to know, they can look it up just by clicking on it. And like I said, over 80% of people will do it, because that's what we've learned from the vocabulary words on Kindle, is that they'll do it. If people are confused or lost by OPA, they'll click on it and find out what it means to keep reading the story.
I feel like there's a ton of stuff that I have cut from my novels
that you could put in the tooltip
back in. Yeah, as tooltips.
Yeah. So they're really cool. So, I mean, as a historical fiction writer, it's not something I need to do a lot of. A lot of it is just done for me because I deal with historical characters and places. But as a sci-fi and fantasy writer, it really opens up doors of opportunity too.
That's cool.
So exposition with description and character emotion. So this is another point from The Expanse. So Jay, do you want to give us a reading?
Yeah. Everything going well with your partner? Havelock's all right, Miller said. Having him around makes people like me better, by contrast. That's nice. Her smile's only change was to become half a degree more genuine. Nothing like a little shared racism to build ties with the boss. Miller nodded respectfully and headed out. His hole was on the 8th level off a residential tunnel 100 meters wide with 50 meters of carefully cultivated green park running down the center. The main corridor's vaulted ceiling was lit by recessed lights and painted a blue that Havelock assured him matched the Earth's summer sky. Living on the surface of a planet, mass sucking at every bone and muscle, and nothing but gravity to keep your air close, seemed like a fast path to crazy. The blue was nice, though.
Okay, so here, there's two things I want to point out in this little piece. And one is that Miller nodded respectfully and headed out. That ends the scene with his boss. And so, like we talked about memory slots, that clears your memory slots. And then we get this lengthy description and some exposition. And then in the end, we get how he feels about it, how he feels about Earth, how he, even though humans are from there, he's never been there, and the idea of being there terrifies him. But he also really likes the color of that blue that he's told looks like the sky. And that's kind of his emotional reaction to the setting. So it's not just a setting. We know how he feels about that setting.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I really like how they did that.
Yeah, like it's a really well done little piece, you know. Not only do we get his emotional reaction to what the blue represents, but we also get his reaction to the blue itself. So this is from John Updike A&P, and A&P is one of his short stories. You can only get it in a bigger collection. And so I was reading Bonnie Johnston, who's a writing coach, and she had talked about this, and so that's kind of where I got this. So she has some really good insight on writing exposition. If you want to look her up, and she had pulled some quotes from A&P. And that's where we got this. So Jay, go ahead and give us the reading.
And I'll just point out, this is a first-person narrator, which is different than our Expanse examples.
Yes.
As I say, we're right in the middle of town, and if you stand at our front doors, you can see two banks and the Congregational Church and the newspaper store and three real estate offices and about 27 old freeloaders tearing up Central Street because the sewer broke again. It's not as if we're on the Cape. We're north of Boston, and there's people in this town haven't seen the ocean for 20 years.
So here he's describing the town, right? It's just, you know, setting, but we get his emotional reaction to it. Like he talks about, you know, 27 freeloaders tearing up Central Street, right? So he's pointing out there's construction workers out there, and he's like, 27 of them are doing nothing. It's like they're just hanging out there. And he also talks about how the people live here and they don't leave the town. You know, that they haven't seen the ocean in 20 years, even though they live really close to it. And so it's not just exposition. It's how he feels about what he's telling us. Again, very similar to the Miller that we saw above. You know, here this is a first-person example, whereas Miller was third. But again, we get a setting, and then we get how they feel about that setting. So we have another example. This is as needed exposition with some character exposition. So go ahead and give us the reading. This, we're back to the Expanse now.
He poured a glass of Moss whiskey, a native Sarah's liquor made from engineered yeast, then took off his shoes and settled onto the foam bed. He could see Candace's disapproving scowl and hear her sigh. He shrugged an apology to her memory and turned back to work. Julia Andromeda Mao. He read through her work history, her academic records, talented pinnacle pilot. There was a picture of her at 18 in a tailored vac suit with the helmet off. Pretty girl with a thin lunar citizen's frame and long black hair. She was grinning like the universe had given her a kiss. The link text said she'd won first place in something called the Parish Dorn 500K. He searched briefly, some kind of race only rich people could afford to fly in. Her pinnace, the Razorback, had beaten the previous record and held it for 2 years.
With the whiskey, we get a single line of exposition to add clarity to the scene. But I don't think it's really needed here, right? Like it's building the world more. But this was a piece of exposition, right? That this Mosque whiskey is just on series. I don't think we really needed it. It was short, so I think, you know, could have gone either way. Why fight about the line? But just from a pure editorial point, I was like, I don't think that added really anything to the scene. The second part is a really interesting point of exposition. And in it, Miller sits down to read a file on Juliet Mao. And as he reads it, we get a summary of the important events. And so it's kind of a very immersive moment as he consumes the exposition on Juliet Mao. We get it with him. And so it's interesting. Like it's very much that straightforward exposition, but it's blended very immersively into the narrative, right? So I thought that was a really interesting way to approach it, and it worked well. I've seen it before. What is it? Mark Dawson did it in The Cleaner. How that's how we get Milton's backstory, right? Milton's gone rogue, so they dig up his file and they read through it, and that's how we get his backstory, is them reading through that file, brushing up before they go to hunt him down. So what are you have any thoughts on that?
No.
Okay. All right. Direct exposition. So go ahead and give us a reading on the next one.
If the big, burly Earther mechanic was carrying a gun, it would make him feel better too, but better not to say it. Let them think the guy in charge felt confident. Holden used his officer's key to open the weapon locker, and Amos took a high-caliber automatic that fired self-propelled rounds, recoilless, and designed for use in zero-G. Old-fashioned slug throwers were more reliable, but in null gravity they were also maneuvering thrusters. A traditional handgun would impart enough thrust to achieve escape velocity from a rock the size of CA-22-1686.
Okay, so this is very direct exposition, right? This explanation of why they need guns that are specifically designed for use in space and what happens. But I, reading through this, like I felt like this was a little too direct, a little too heavy, and I think it would have been better if it had been converted into a conversation, right? I think Amos should turn to Holden and say, I knew this guy who shot himself off an asteroid using an old-fashioned gunpowder slug thrower. The moment he fired it, the recoil launched him right out into space. I don't think we ever found him, right? And so it changes it into this little piece of backstory, not saying you have to use a special gun in zero-G, but rather pointing out an old-fashioned gunpowder slug thrower and why you can't use it in space. What happens? It launches you, right?
Yeah, man, so, I love your example, actually. That's really good.
So, yeah, so I felt like it was rough, and had they converted it into this little story, you know, I think it would have done well and would have told us a little bit about Amos, right? He found it funny that this guy shot himself into space and probably died out there because the guy was an idiot, and Amos, you know, kind of has that view on people. If you're an idiot, you deserve the trouble it brings you.
And so, just kind of another thought on this, like, we all have to learn things, like even on Earth, so when you're not writing sci-fi, we all have to learn things. And so there's pretty much always a time that you can jump back and talk about the time where the character learned that weird thing.
Yeah. Because essentially what I've done is I've substituted backstory for exposition. That's what I've done, right?
Yeah.
I've converted the exposition into a piece of backstory, and it's this little story that Amos tells Holden.
Yeah, that's cool. I like it, dude. Good job.
So my thought was that that didn't work, and that's how I would solve the problem of that piece of heavy exposition. So I guess another way to approach it would be to make it part of it, right? So maybe there's a guy that Amos doesn't really like on the crew, and they're going out, and Amos hands him an old-fashioned revolver. And tells him, you know, if things get tough, use this. And he chuckles. And maybe he remembers when he saw a guy launch himself into space. And now it's not just piece of dialogue. It's not just backstory. There's tension there. Be like, Amos just tried to get that guy launched into space. And that guy may not know enough not to use that gun.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Dude, that's great. How are you thinking of this stuff?
You just up the tension, because now we've taken it through steps. We started with the really hard exposition. We moved it into backstory and dialogue. And then finally, we've moved it into a plot point. And at a plot point, that's when the editor stops telling you, pull this out as exposition and backstory. Because at that point, it's part of the story. Just like Luke, I am your father. At that point, it is part of the story. And no editor is going to tell you to pull it. In exposition and dialogue, there's a few things to kind of watch out for. So one is the as you know, Bob. I know we've covered this as a smaller point in something else. But essentially, the key phrase is as you know. And this started out in TVs where writers were probably being told not to do it for a long time. But it really became an issue in television when writers were trying to find a way. How do I convey exposition and backstory when I have no narrative? I only have dialogue. And so in these early TV shows, you started to get this as you know, and then they would say the thing the person already knows. And the reason this was problematic was because both characters knew it. It wasn't immersive. It wasn't like they were living in this other world and we were watching them. It was like they were performing for us.
Yeah, and it takes you out of the story.
Takes you out, yeah. And
if you notice that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's a lot of variations on this. As you know, let me sum up. Let's review. Tell me again. All of these are essentially trying to get two people who already know a piece of information to say it so the audience will know it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's because so to sum up, it's usually better to have exposition in dialogue. Like it can be stronger, but if you do as you know, Bob, it's much worse.
It's yeah.
So avoid this trap because it's going to be tempting to just put it into dialogue, but it needs to be genuine. Like the characters would actually say it, or it's worse than the alternative.
Yeah. Better to have it in narrative than doing as you know, Bob. So another thing that can happen is when exposition is presented as dialogue is it can become a kind of lecture, right? Like a character just goes on for page and page. Like if you've ever read anything by Ayn Rand, this is what her characters do. They deliver like 10-page lectures where no one else says anything. They just go. And, you know, that's just how she writes her novels. And the reason, unless you have somebody giving a lecture, a lot of times this isn't how things go, right? Like people usually don't tolerate you just talking for long periods of time without interrupting, raising questions, or voicing their own opinions.
Yeah. And I've only read Atlas Shrugged, but I almost felt like that was less of a novel and more of a lecture. Like it's a philosophical treatise more than a novel.
It is.
If you're going to do a treatise, then fine, do a lecture. But yeah, most of the time, that's not what readers are there for.
But I mean, at the same time, like if one character is explaining something to another, it can have kind of a lecture feel. And so the thing to look at here is to have the secondary character ask questions. Maybe they challenge the speaker's knowledge. They can react emotionally to significant information, or maybe they can prod the character along to get to the point, or maybe the speaker is withholding information that the other character has to kind of extract from them. And then, or you can let the personal relationship with the speaker interfere with the conversation. Of course, we have action beats, and I'll refer back to that great moment in cinema where you have Ramses and Moses in the tent having this conversation. And at no point does Ramses say, "You have become more trouble than you're worth." But the whole time the conversation is going on, Ramses is stacking weights on a scale. You know, one for every good thing in his relationship with Moses, and one for every plague and trouble the people have caused him. And by the end of the dialogue, the scale tips, right? He stacks so many pieces on it that it's not balanced anymore. And so if that's converted into text, those are the action beats, and they're very powerful, right?
Yeah.
As Ramses, he has this long piece of dialogue, but the action he takes during that dialogue is so significant and powerful because he's telling Moses, "You are now more trouble than you are worth." So flashbacks are a way of putting in that backstory. And they can be action packed scenes that really pull the story forward while revealing past events. But the real issue with a flashback is that they need to have stakes that matter when the flashback is over, right? So if in the flashback we see your character hanging over the edge of the cliff, we immediately know they survived that because they're having a flashback of that event. But maybe this is a flashback of them stealing something. And we see the video recording. And then in the current scene, we see that somebody is watching this tape. And this person has no intention of turning them over to police. This person has an intention of blackmailing them. Now, the flashback has stakes for what's happening now in the story. So, and another point is when you're in the middle of a bunch of action, don't go into a flashback because those slots are filled with the current dialogue and action that's going on. You need to clear those memory slots before you jump into that flashback, or the reader won't remember where they are when you come back out of it. Also, whenever you do a flashback, you're going to want to go to a dynamic scene, not a dull one. particularly because a flashback requires building a new scene, and that's an investment that doesn't move the plot forward. So you need to make sure that, that once that flashback gets going, that it really moves at a fast pace. Because like I said, you know, anytime you build a setting, you're slowing things down, and you need to make that investment of building a new setting worthwhile, you know, and that's why a lot of times, you know, we tell people when you have a setting, try to stay there as long as possible. And if you can't, try to pick a different setting where you can stay as long as possible, so you don't have to build a new one. All right. So that's end of part two. The notes continue for quite a while, so we will break this into a part three. We apologize for the very, very late release of this. Jay was out of town, and then I was just really busy, and then we had coronavirus. Oh, and then we had a computer crash as well. So we did a recording, and then halfway through, or maybe even more than that, it crashed, and we didn't have time to start over. So that's the reason we are so late in the release. I know I got a few emails that people were worried we had stopped doing the podcast, but it just life has been busy and crazy. So, and you know, that's why we're recording remotely today, is just to maintain our social distance.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for listening. We appreciate your support, and we love receiving the emails from you, hearing what you think about it. And also, we wish you the best during this crazy time we're all going through.
Yeah. So, since you're all stuck at home, it's time to start writing.